This is Radio Freethinker, episode 75. History never repeats. I tell myself before I go to sleep. Don't say the words you might regret. I lost before, you know I can't forget. There was a girl I used to know. She dealt my love a savage blow. I was so young, too blind to see. That's history. I say history never repeats. I tell myself before I go to sleep. Don't say the words you might regret. I lost before, you know I can't forget. You say I always play the fool. I can go on if that's the rule. Better to jump than head.
Hello and welcome to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist and after homeopathic hypnotist talk giver.
Gonna have to explain that one after. And this is Daniel, UBC Freethinkers president and economics student here at UBC. And now Rob, please explain.
A lot of people who might listen to this show know that I gave a talk last Friday for the New Bright Lights lecture series. And as Fred Bremer commented on Facebook, for New Bright Lights, there sure are a few dim bulbs. The talk that was right before me was a guy called Rob Hadley, who runs a hypnotherapy center here in Vancouver, and he was giving a talk about, ostensibly, hypnosis and how it works. But in the middle of it, he started ranting about how homeopathy works, which was like, I was thinking...
What does that have to do with hypnosis?
Well, in some ways, isn't that sort of a self-ad hominem attack on himself? I mean, so I'm going to tell you all about hypnotism, and you can trust me because I believe in homeopathy.
Like, I was sort of thinking because before that he was talking about how people are suggestible, and we've all sort of been hypnotized throughout our life by, you know, zoning out when we're playing video games or between the commercials during a TV show. And he started talking about how he uses people's suggestibility to help them and sort of reinforce their will in order to help them quit smoking, or in the anecdote he gave, helping a woman want to stop drinking. And he's talking about how he gives her a pill and says, "This will make you want to stop drinking." And she comes back and says, blah, 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 blah. And I was thinking, like, oh, great. He's using her beliefs to, you know, sort of against her in a way to help her stop drinking. But no, he comes out and says that this proves that homeopathy works. To which I sort of thought, well, didn't you just say that things work because people are suggestible and the homeopathy pill might work because people are suggestible, in which case it's just a placebo effect, like every known reliable study has shown so far?
Well, I like how he justified it as, it works. I know people say it doesn't work, but it does.
Yeah.
That was his evidence. That was his assertion was, it works. And then when people asked him questions afterward, he was like, but it works. No, it doesn't. It just does. It works.
Actually, the questions from the audience afterwards, there were quite a few skeptics in it. This riled them, as you might imagine, and Brian Lichihan came out and had a particularly pointed question that basically said, you know, all the evidence suggests that, based on double-blind trials, that homeopathy doesn't work. And Rob Hadley went on to sort of say, well, double-blind trials aren't valid because people are different.
Oh, of course.
And the point of double-blind studies are not to take into account people are different.
Doesn't that just prove him wrong as well, if anything?
Yeah. So just to make sure, he wasn't being confused. Like, when he says it works, he wasn't saying it works because of the placebo effect. Like, I mean, like he was, because you could make that claim.
No,
that homeopathy works because of the placebo effect and not because of homeopathy's mystic beliefs.
Like later on in the talk, he started talking about how modern doctors with their lab coats and their clipboards are just like witch doctors in other countries, in which, you know, what they tell you is nonsense, and if you believe it, it becomes true. Like if a doctor says you have 6 months to live, you are going to die in 6 months. It's revealing a sort of intense mistrust of medical authority. And that sort of, I guess, goes along with his saying that homeopathy works and no amount of medical research is going to prove me wrong.
The great thing about his talk was it was just an epic fail on his part in every regard. He failed to provide evidence that homeopathy works, but he also failed to hypnotize people. He had these people on stage and he's trying to hypnotize them and he's trying to get this girl to slide out of her chair. And she's not sliding out of her chair. And he's like, you're going to fall out of your chair now.
It feels like it's full of oil. It's so slippery.
He starts like kind of like tugging on her arm, and she kind of just opens her eyes and is like, no, it's not going to happen. And he was just like, oh, well, you didn't go under deep enough and blah, blah, blah. It was quite funny.
So that talk will be up on YouTube soon. I gave the talk right afterwards, which was a little more evidence-based. I'll let the viewers and listeners judge which talk was more impressive. Actually, the first talk was kind of interesting. It was Lon Mandrake doing his talk about how he uses magic to teach science in the classroom. And it was a bit like having your uncle sort of talk to you about what he does, but it was still mildly entertaining.
Yeah, it was pretty good. Well, why don't we get on to today's show? We have a fantastic show today. Actually, later on, we're going to have an interview with Michael Shermer, which is going to be really interesting. Before we get to that, we should talk about Stats Canada.
Well, actually, I wanted to do an update. Actually, we might get more than one update on this, but we've done a show before about the Canadian census, the long-form census, and the Harper's government's attempt to, well, not attempt, it has, abolished the mandatory long-form census and maintained the mandatory short-form census. Recently, Stockwell Day, who was the head of the Treasury Board, although I think he's been shuffled to a different department now.
Remember when the most notable newsworthy thing about Stockwell Day was him showing up to a talk, you know, wearing a wetsuit on a jet ski?
Yes. Well, now his department, I guess him indirectly, plans to spend billions of dollars on new prisons. To support this, he states that the number of unreported crimes is on the increase and that therefore the number of crimes must be increasing.
Wait, unreported crimes? Yeah. How does he know? They're unreported.
Well, and you
because,
know,
because there's a number underneath the 911 that says Stockwell Day.
He's a masked vigilante.
Well, even that, I mean, because then they'd be reported, wouldn't they? And actually, it goes against Stats Can, which is where this is starting to lead into, which shows actually that the gross number of crimes have gone down, as well as what they call the severity of crimes. And the severity of crimes is a relative calculation. So the idea that even if the total number of crimes go down, but if they all used to be bike crimes, and now they're all rape crimes, well, the severity of crimes have gone up. And this factors in severity versus numbers. And even that number has come down, although it's waffled a bit more stably.
So both the number of crimes and the severity has gone down, according to Stats Canada.
Right. The peak, actually, for severity, since they started doing this record, which was in 1999 was pretty high, and actually 2006 was pretty high. 2006 is an important number, but we'll get back to that later. Now, he also says that, you know, with regards to this number, right, Stats Canada's numbers about the total crimes, whatever, he says that that the stats showing that crimes are declining in Canada are not accurate, that the value of information gathered by the census suggests that data older than a year is untenable in today's information age.
Now, I'm just curious. Do we get our information on crime and crime severity from the census? I would assume that's from other stats that Stats Can does, not the census.
Presumably from police reports.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, that's actually a good point. Because going over the last thing, I don't think there was any question saying, have you been a victim of a crime this year or anything
like
that.
Well, yeah, because if he's saying that Stats Can is wrong and they get their information from the police, then isn't he saying people who should know best are wrong, so we're going to build them more prisons?
Well, and it gets better. So when reporters scratch their head saying, well, this doesn't make any sense. So when pressed to find out what his source of unreported crimes was, a few days later after this news conference, his office came back and said that the information came from a StatsCan survey. A national victimization. Now, this is, again, it's a voluntary survey that they do. They do it every 5 years. The last one, which apparently is the source for Stockwell Day's information, there's a new one due out at the end of the year, but it's not out yet, was done in 2006, which I think is more than a year ago. So by Stockwell Day's own judgment, these stats are unreliable.
Why did you say 2006 had more crime? Was there a reason for that?
Well, yes, because I've plotted to have 2000. No, there's a correlate that this last survey was done did seem to occur, according to the other Stats Can's information, at a peak. Now, I'm not sure exactly why there was a peak of crimes in that particular year, or the fear of crime, right? But that did seem to, there did seem to correlation. So if Stockwell Day wanted to make the claim that we had bad crime, that was the year to pick, because it seemed to be an abnormally high year for crime. Because on both sides of the graph that I saw online, it was significantly lower, right? But it even gets better than that. These same surveys, right? And there's actually two of them. There's a national survey of victimization, and there's an international survey, which goes beyond Canada. But the national survey showed as well that over 80 to 90% of people, it's like some of them were 96, depending on the province or your age group, were satisfied with the police, satisfied with judiciary, and satisfied with prison system. That compared to other Western nations, we were better off than England, a little worse than France, but we're pretty average. We're in the stats. We're Finnish. Finland reported very close to ours as far as international numbers go.
Keep in mind, though, that's just personal opinion. These people are experts.
Self-reported data is tricky to analyze.
Yeah, it's hard to really say because a country is happier with their police, it's better policing. It just might be that the police do a better job of
covering up any problems.
I wasn't going to go that far, but I mean, there are like police campaigns to raise like public acceptance of what they do.
I just two more things, and one will be a lead out, and one just for clarification. We sometimes make mistakes, and I'm pretty sure that last time we covered this, I had stated that the fine for not filling in your mandatory sentence was $5,000. Harper, and this is where it came to my attention more, that we might be wrong, has been saying $10,000. I actually went to the Statistics Act, and apparently it's actually only $1,000 is the amount you can. Having said that, again, there is still no record of anyone ever being charged with that. And in fact, actually, on an online poll, which of course is totally reliable, from the CBC, that over 80% of the respondents actually wanted to keep the mandatory long form. So, I mean, the internet, you know, doesn't lie, does it?
Nope.
And never
lies.
Well,
they're CBC listeners, so.
That's right. True.
Why don't we go to a commercial break, and we'll be back with some more on Radio Free Thinking.
Hey, this is Randy Randall from No Age. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Thanks a lot.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free friends card, and feel the love.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we want to segue from StatsCan and to an internet question. Actually, this is another sort of recap or revisit from last week's show. And what spurred this on is we got an email, very, very angry email, actually. And I'm just going to read...
Vitriolic.
I was amazed at how he managed to get spittle into an email.
Quite the feat. So I'm just going to read a bit to you guys.
Read this email from
to our listeners.
This seething monster.
Hey guys, First of all, great job with the show. I've been enjoying it lately, and I feel you've really come into your own.
He didn't even try and hold back.
I know. What a... It's a must-listen on my weekly podcast gambit. That being said, I was a little frustrated, and frustrated is triple underlined, with your Google security segment you did last week. I feel you were doing a bit of, is there a word for fear-mongering? It seemed like you were saying a lot of scary things that there isn't actually any evidence for, or at least you didn't present any. For example, at one point, Don, triple underlined, said that he researched the segment using Google, but how does he know that that search wasn't biased? Well, I know you didn't outright say that Google does bias searches. You certainly planted a seed of doubt. But is there any evidence of Google searches being biased? I know that there is a lot of evidence that their searches are unbiased and follow a specific algorithm involving linking that they are very proud of. Also, their work with the CIA, you made it seem like they have nefarious intentions when there is no evidence for this. Again, at least not that you presented. Well, I do enjoy Google's products. I definitely have nothing against exposing them or any company when they do something wrong. But I feel like you guys were veering towards sounding like a big anti, big government, big corporation show when it's really supposed to be about a show about skepticism and critical thinking. Anyway, I'm definitely still a huge fan and enjoy listening every week. I just wanted to share what I was thinking.
First of all, actually, just to one, I love big... If anyone's listened to this, I love big governments. I think they're cool. That we need big government. But there's two aspects to this, just to one. Google does have a history of censoring, and it had a big conflict with China, where China said, listen, get out, or we're going to... if you don't filter the results. So it wasn't unfounded. But you are right. I did set the seed there, and... the interactions with the CIA, again, there was a seed in the fairies, only because, not that I think it's Google itself was bad or that there's anything there, but Google's place in our society is changing. It's become, what was the stat I heard, that over 75% of people use Google every month. Every month.
75% of internet users, which is about 1 billion people.
Right, and we've become so heavily reliant on it. And my point about me using Google to look up Google just seemed to strike me as actually humorous, not nefarious, but it just shows that it has a very special place in our society, and that maybe, maybe not, it's time we take a look at it like we would the CIA. If the CIA was doing something like this, we would say it's a government institution and we should look into it. So maybe Google's made that point, but maybe not.
So you were calling for more transparency on the part of Google and their dealings.
I was actually just calling for the question, is that should we start treating Google differently than we do other ones? Microsoft kind of is in the same situation where it's by some considered to have a combine or a cartel because it controls such a large percentage of the market, right? And because information is important, especially to skeptics, it's just something I thought we should look at. And yes, it was leading talk, but that's just because skeptics should be asking these questions, even if they're wrong.
Well, I did read a Wall Street Journal article based off of dozens of interviews with former and current Google employees and internal documents leaked to the Wall Street Journal. And it basically says that Google and its founders have been remarkably good at protecting users' data. And the many people within Google are so resistant to any use of personal data that goes too far, and even to the extent that it's like a competitive handicap to them. So for Google's advertising, until very recently, they never installed cookies onto people's browsers, which would allow them to track what users are doing, which is incredibly common practice amongst websites. That happens every time you get on the internet, pretty much. And Google resisted that for a long time. So when I was making these hypothetical statements last time, I wasn't trying to say that Google is bad. Google's probably one of the better companies out there for protecting your privacy. But the potential there for them to start caving into pressure from large shareholders because your privacy is not profitable, it's there, and it's something that you might want to be worried about.
BlackBerry caved to foreign governments. Google eventually started using cookies. It's best to be aware of what might happen in the future.
And again, even if Google right now is a good and honorable company, which, again, I'm not trying to say that they are, but what if Google gets bought out by Lex Luthor? or something. Once
very
once,
likely.
Once we as a society allows it to have this power, should it be treated separately? And actually, this is something where I think me and Daniel might end up on opposite sides, because, I mean, I'm big for regulation. I think you don't innately trust corporations, and that regulation is good. And once a company reaches a certain threshold, it is no longer truly a private company, but has become a public interest.
I think on the subject of fear-mongering versus or skeptical inquiry, I think that it's sort of a with great power argument, I think. I think that Google does occupy a realm that is kind of new territory for us. And because so many people access the internet via Google, and because Google has that kind of reputation and authority, I think it's fair to have a healthy skepticism towards Google. Now, I don't think we were being too overtly fear-mongering with them, but I do think that it's you know, within the mandate of skepticism to at least be cautious.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to realize that none of us have contracts with Google saying they're going to protect our privacy completely. They can change their current policies, which are pretty good. I feel totally comfortable with the current policies giving Google way too much personal stuff. I mean, Gmail, like, every email I get goes to Google, and they certainly scan it, at least, because I get ads based off of it. But I don't feel bad doing that. I think it's good. I mean, and I left Facebook for privacy concerns, so I'm clearly someone kind of skeptical of internet corporations.
I think, too, there's a noteworthy difference between the implied or the hints that I gave versus someone else who might be, for example, we were talking before with Rob about homeopathy. So I'm sitting there and I'm saying, well, maybe there's a hint that Google could do this, and they could, but there's no proof. And so I've raised the question. Now, if I raised the question and said, therefore you should use Bing or Yahoo or something, well, then I'm putting skeptical questions not to promote the idea of skepticism. I'm doing them in order to get you to go to my marketing site or go to my thing. So if I say that the homeopathy works, well, I might be like some Sonia people that we know of who actually sells the product, and maybe there's a conflict of interest. So yeah, there were hints in there, and perhaps they're nefarious hints, but they're only hints and they're not facts. And I'm raising the question.
Right. One aspect that we touched on last week was the notion of Google and Verizon coming up with an internet deal, and we were a bit concerned about net neutrality with that deal. Well, recently they've released sort of a tentative agreement that is, I mean, again, to sort of keep in the same line, well, it can sound scary if you frame it the right way. It is very vague, and a couple internet websites have published some interesting thoughts and theories about these new ideas. So we wanted to take a look at them here. Essentially, what Verizon and Google want is to maintain a private internet. So basically to have the standard internet that we all know and love, but then have a sort of a special, you know, accelerated first-class internet, sort of, where, you know, you could get fast delivery of what they sort of mention as medical service or education, but, I mean, you would just also assume entertainment, games, whatever.
Porn.
You want. Perhaps. Why not? Verizon's public policy blog says the proposal, quote, includes safeguards to ensure that online services must be distinguishable from traditional broadband internet access service and are not designed to circumvent the rules. So I guess what they're trying to say there is we're not going to create a two-tiered internet that's going to eventually sort of marginalize the free internet and make it, you know, paid and violate net neutrality. Now, I was reading an article on PCWorld.com, basically raising some potential red flags, and I thought we should maybe take a look at them. One of them that they raise is the question that I think on most people's mind is how would this so-called private internet work? Would you have it sort of a private internet for business? Does this mean that Verizon can say to companies that use this private service that their products, say games for instance, take up too much bandwidth and have to pay more?
Or with your Verizon wireless thing, would you only have access to the Verizon standard internet? And if you wanted to use any other kind of internet, you'd have to pay more or not have access to it at all?
Or if you didn't use Verizon, would you have to pay more to get onto this?
Yeah.
The other thing that they kind of raised was, what does, quote, lawful internet content mean exactly?
Well, I have an idea about that. I was looking at some of the cell phone providers, and
if you pay to access the internet via their mobile browsers, they can have basically provisions to block any content that they deem inappropriate. And I was looking through the list of some things that, for example, AT&T blocks. And this includes some, porn and things about how to make bombs, but it also blocks things like websites about abortion or sexual education. So
Are they owned by, like, the Christian Writer or something?
I don't know, but I found this on AT&T's website.
I don't think they actually do this, though, and I'd have to double-check, but I've never heard anything about major blockage of website by AT&T, and I read lots of gadget blogs.
Actually, no, I was just listening just today to Democracy Now!, so I can't tell you the exact name of the company, but it was a major phone company in the United States where an abortion rights group sent out an email about a bill that was passing, and they said, hey, everyone, you should support this or whatever, right? And the company blocked the email, which raises two real important things. One, they knew what was being said. And two, they did. They said, we think abortion is morally wrong, and we don't like this email. So they stopped the broadcast of that information.
One thing that they might be talking about when they say unlawful content could be peer-to-peer downloading.
Now, no.
Yes.
No.
Yes. The problem with this is it's not necessarily illegal. In fact, several movies have been distributed legally via these methods.
As well as operating systems. You can get Ubuntu and various flavors of Linux as a torrent.
Exactly. So, I mean, these actually are useful methods when used, I think, fairly. So that's a big question right there, is are these services going to be blocked? Now, the other question that kind of popped into my mind was, well, what's going to happen to the regular internet? The Google Verizon proposal appears to make room for a two-tiered internet. Now, after this demarcation, would broadband providers be compelled to maintain and upgrade regular internet services? Or even could carriers cap regular internet speeds at a certain level and then force users to move over to the second tier if they wanted better broadband speed?
Okay, I'm going to stop this for a little bit. First of all, we're kind of acting as if they can do whatever the hell they want, which isn't exactly true.
Actually,
and more so in the U.S. than Canada. In Canada, for instance, you basically have TELUS and Shaw where we live. But in the U.S., you have quite a few choices for internet providers in most major areas. If one decides to put this tiered pricing system in place, aren't people just going to jump ship to another one unless there's a compelling reason for customers to want to stay with, say, Verizon when they have a tiered plan, whereas AT&T offers a regular internet?
That's the libertarian fallacy. Sorry. Because it's based upon rational choice theory, which actually doesn't work in reality. But the second the second aspect to it is you're implying that there's going to be a straight, when they come out, they're going to say, well, listen, you're going to have our plan, the private plan, which is going to cost you $100 more, but it's going to give you 100 times the speed, or you can go with the regular plan, the boring plan, which is going to be like $10.
Not even just speed, but if you take their private plan, then you'll have better and improved access to Google. That's the thing that's going on here with Google and Verizon. They're creating a private internet that will have privileged access to Google's services from Verizon and vice versa.
So going back to the idea is that when it's introduced, it's going to be introduced incrementally, small, because as you point out, they couldn't just come up there and slap on this huge thing because everyone would jump ship. And second of all, it's also implying that one group will and the other group won't. But remember when they introduced the fee for text messaging, right? When you receive text messaging, right? Everyone said, it's so stupid. But almost, I think there's one phone company now that doesn't actually charge you for incoming text messages, but everyone else says there is a theoretical charge to incoming text messages.
At least in North America.
So there was a great opportunity for a divergence of ability to the capitalistic advantage, right? Hey, I can do this, you don't. But all the other ones just joined in, say, hey, listen, this is a good moneymaker, we'll join you. So I can't see why the same thing wouldn't happen if Verizon does it, why Sprint won't do it, why everyone will say, hey, this is a great model, let's see if we can cash in.
Getting sort of onto what Daniel and you guys have just been talking about, when it comes to cost, because we don't really have a way of knowing there's no precedent for this so far, there's sort of only kind of half precedents like cell phones and cable companies, but they could structure the process sort of like a cable structure so that, you know, you get your basic cable, which is we all probably have, and then you have sort of the benefits, you know, like the digital the channels, the, you know, HD, Discovery, blah, 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 right? So in theory, Verizon and Google could structure this sort of like, well, you get the basic package that, you know, everybody loves, but then you get, you know, Google Medical or whatever they're going to call this thing, where you get, you know, streaming access to unlimited medical blah blah blah. So then other companies might feel tempted to say, okay, well, we're also going to have a premium service that, again, no pressure to join up, but if you do join up, you know, you're going to get a little bit extra from Yahoo and AT&T or something, right?
Yeah, I mean, it could happen, but I don't think it's necessarily this horrible thing. Now, let's just think about this for a second. Imagine Google, what are some other big sites? Facebook, Twitter, a bunch of the major internet sites that people are most likely to go to, say to Verizon, okay, look, we will together put in like 50 cents towards you or towards any subscription you get to our premium service, and basically subsidize that for people, so people can get their services completely free over the internet, and they might not get access to everything else, but they can go to at least those for free. I don't see how that's necessarily this horrible, horrible thing. I mean, I like the idea of a free and open internet where everyone gets the same bandwidth potential, and I'd be the first to jump ship from any phone or any provider that doesn't give me that. But at the same time, I don't see this as wholly bad like so many other people seem to. It might allow for cheaper internet access, maybe to maybe limited in some ways to people who can't otherwise afford the free and open internet.
There is a debate about this going on. The FCC has to debate about whether or not they're currently talking about how net neutrality should work and tabling that with all the different senators and congressmen in the states. And the FCC has to sign off on this Google
actually,
Verizon thing.
Actually, I believe, no, they don't. I believe one of the last vestiges of the Bush administration was they reworded the FCC's mandate so as that the internet is no longer considered to be a broadcast medium but an entertainment medium. And as such, it's no longer, the FCC technically has no longer the mandate to actually regulate it.
Yeah, it's true. There's also a court decision that solidified that the FCC is not allowed to impose net neutrality.
Oh, well, never mind then. We're all doomed.
just to close that and to go to a different area that maybe we haven't thought about, but there is actually another implication of all this, is that in order to do this, they do something called packet sniffing, so they know where it's coming from and what's in it. And this is something that's been occurring pretty much all the time, but maybe a lot of people don't know. You mentioned Google reads your email, but in a way, so does.
Well, okay.
I know what you meant, but in the same way, though, Shaw or your Rogers or your internet provider also reads your packets. Not
as long as it's not encrypted.
To a certain depth, right? Mm-hmm. And that allows them to say, well, this is what you're doing. How do they know if it's an illegal website? Well, they look at it and they say, well, the particular shell around this particular packet of data is the same kind of shell you'd use for a torrent. So it says, oh, this must be a torrent. And they can actually drill down further than that, although that's more questionable. But the idea is that, you know, if they do this, they're going to have to snoop even deeper into what you're actually sending in order to know, you know, did this come from this website or that website or this content or that content?
It's true. I mean, there already are ISPs that do throttle peer-to-peer. And
throttle? What do you mean throttle?
Like slow it down. So you're not getting your maximum connection speed over peer-to-peer. And the reason for this, which I think is a legitimate reason on their part most of the time, is that if some people constantly have peer-to-peer on, it eventually reaches somewhere where there's a bottleneck where it's slowing down other people's internet access. So for some things like that, there are logical and not horrible reasons why they're doing these things.
Which is why government regulation is good. But on another topic.
This is clearly a controversial topic, so if you have any comments, questions, or suggestions about it, or anything else on the show, please email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
Right. Let's take a commercial break, and we'll be back with some more on Radio Free Thinker.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
So vote
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
Yeah, the state of hip hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. I draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
Welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. So let's go into our interview. Today we have Michael Shermer. He is the editor-in-chief of Skeptic Magazine, the founder of the Skeptic Society in California, and author of such books as Why People Believe Weird Things and Denying History.
Hello, listeners. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian at TAM in Las Vegas, and I'm here with Michael Shermer. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
So, I'm a big fan of history, as you know, and I'm a big fan of your book, Denying History.
Oh, right.
So I wanted to ask you, where does history fit in with skepticism?
Right. Well, I think if we treat history and historical claims like any claim and treat it as a science, then it's part of the skeptical world. In that sense, it would be no different than geology, which is a historical science, archaeology, which is historical science, much of cosmology. Most of cosmology is, in a way, a historical science. And, of course, evolutionary biology. It's all history. It's the history of life. So all of those are sciences that formulate hypotheses and then figure out clever ways to test hypotheses to see if this is true or that is true. And the problem is human history is always treated differently, like it's in the humanities, like it's a art instead of a science, like it's the way you write the narrative is more important than what actually happened or something like that. And so the field of history has always been burdened by that, I think. And so what I'm trying to do is just treat it like any other claim. Any past claim is just like any other claim you can test.
Right. One of the problems maybe skeptics see with history is that it relies a lot on firsthand evidence, testimony, eyewitness accounts, and sort of modern science has taught us that these can be very unreliable.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's true. You have to take that into account, of course, and look for corroborating evidence from other sources and see which way the evidence converges toward this hypothesis or that hypothesis, given the limitations of self-report data. But, of course, that's true in all of the social sciences. I mean, all poll data that we all bank on for politics and economics and social trends and, you know, any poll you've ever heard is self-report data. They just ask people, do you believe in God, or are you conservative, or who are you voting for? You know, there's a certain assumption there that we're getting a real answer. Mm-hmm. And also that the person really knows what they believe, and sometimes they don't. So we already have that problem with other areas that we have to deal with. There are certain limitations to that, but you just take that into account.
So what about how certain historians can look at the same evidence and come up with completely different interpretations? How do you see the role of interpreting history for the historian? How can they have a critical thinking, logical way of analyzing evidence so that they don't come up with completely different takes on the same event?
Right. Like, what would be an example?
Well, maybe you could take any war or conflict where one side comes across as defending democracy,
oh,
for
right.
instance.
Yeah, yeah.
The other side is, well, you know, we had to expand our borders to survive.
Right, yeah, yeah. One man's freedom fighter is another country's terrorist, yeah. Well, obviously there is a human subjective element there of interpretation that it's hard to get around. So I guess the question would be, what's the specific question on the table? I mean, there it's like, was this a good war or a bad war? You know, that may not be in the same category of scientific questions as, you know, what precisely happened, when, and how many were killed or whatever. Like, the rape of Nanking is one of these poorly documented areas that's getting more attention now. And there we can establish what happened and so on. The other question, though, is, you know, why do countries do that or whatever? That sort of starts to blend over it more into moral issues and things like that. Not that science can't inform us on those, but admittedly, that's a different problem. And so there may not be a solution to that. I mean, it's in a different category than, say, geologists all agreeing on something of the past because there is a moral component to it.
What's your take on more sort of postmodern views of history, that because we shape history through our interpretations, we're completely unreliable in talking about something that happened a long time ago, for instance, the slave trade, or even World War I, for instance?
Right.
There's all these ideas that, well, we weren't there, so
yes.
You can't know
yeah.
for sure.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah, sure, we weren't there, but we weren't there for the pyramids being built, but you know, we know they were built. There they are. We have a good idea of how they were built, although, see, even there you get people that don't accept the standard explanation for how the pyramids were built, and so you end up with a fringe element claiming it was the Atlanteans or aliens, mm-hmm. whatever. But for the most part, there's a consensus amongst the community of scholars who study a particular area. And so we rely on them, not on faith, but on confidence that they have checks and balances within their own community, much like we do for other areas we can't check. I mean, you and I don't know anything about string theory, I mean, quantum physics, you know, some of these esoteric sciences. We kind of have to take it not on faith, but on confidence that the community of people that do know that have already worked out amongst themselves, because it's a competitive enterprise, you know, what's probably true and what's probably not, and so we go to them as our experts, much like the, you know, panel, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. I believe them based on faith. It's like I just know how science works. It's very competitive, and somebody really could advance their career if they could debunk a data set and show that it was wrong. And if they, and therefore, we would hear about that, and yet we don't. So that tells me that there's more confidence in that consensus. This consensus sounds like a bad word, like it's a democracy. Science is not a democracy like that, but there is a kind of a general consensus among a group of experts, you know, that we know this and we're not sure about that, and we're still exploring over here, and that's, I think, a fairly reliable system.
Okay. Well, shifting gears a bit, I want to talk about Holocaust denial. And you were one of the first to openly debate Holocaust deniers. And that raised a lot of controversy. I'm curious, what did your colleagues say to you when you first started going on talk shows to debate these people?
I only think I did two talk shows, so it wasn't a big deal. And I did one debate. I just thought it'd be fun to mix it up with these guys and go into the beast of the belly, mm-hmm. and hang out with them just to see what it was like. I like doing that so I can get inside somebody's head to try to understand why they believe this. Do they really believe the Holocaust didn't happen? Yeah, they really do. For the most part, if we mean by Holocaust didn't happen that 6 million didn't die, it was 1 or 2 million or whatever, and that they weren't gassed, they died of other causes, and there was no orchestrated plan by the Nazi regime to eradicate European Jewry. That's what they deny. They don't deny that lots of people died and that it was a nasty war and that there's anti-Semitism. Nobody denies that. So once you clarify that, then you go, okay, but why do you believe that? Because here's the data. Mm-hmm. And there you start to see where ideology kicks in. And I think what was really obvious to me was in David Irving's trial, in which professional historians in a court of law presented him, where he couldn't dodge and weave his way out of it, the evidence for it, and he still didn't change his mind. That tells you it's dogmatism and denial, not science and skepticism.
What's your opinion on perhaps an urge to keep Holocaust denial out of the curriculum, to label it as denialism and not, as they would like to call it, revisionism?
Yes. Well, you know, I think the market essentially determines those things. I'm not too worried about Holocaust revisionism or denial because it's so small now. I'm much more worried about things like creationism, which morphed into intelligent design, which really got legs and took off. And that 40% figure remains pretty solid. People that believe that, it's pretty disturbing. It's the numbers, mm-hmm. and the social influence they have on politics that determines whether we want to pay attention to it or not. So when we got into the Holocaust denial stuff, they were fairly prominent. They were all over the place, and the polls show that, you know, a lot of people thought it might be possible that, you know, that the story we're getting is not true and so on. So that's when we jumped in there. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with climate change. I mean, there's a lot of people. I mean, the polls show, you know, just, you know, like a third to half Americans are very skeptical of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, their conclusions. They're skeptical of that. So we better get in there and mix it up and see what this is all about.
Sort of on that vein, I was going to ask you about history textbooks, but it's actually a good segue into
science textbooks and influencing school boards into picking textbooks which are free of ideology like creationism or historic revisionism. What is the best way of doing that?
Well, I guess since this is America without a central planning committee for education and curriculum, is you have to take it to the streets, committee by committee, which is why those battles are important of who gets on a school board, like we saw a case with Texas with that guy McElroy, who managed to get the textbooks revised politically. And that's an example of, I think, where when you treat history as a humanities subjective thing rather than a science, then anybody's opinion is as good as anybody else's, and we're just fighting about opinions. It'd be better if we could get beyond that.
Prior to the more modern age, history had this notion of being written by very British historians with their pipe and talking about the glorious British Empire. How do we counter the people who say, well, history is just a humanities because you rely on those books for your evidence? How do we impart to them that we're looking between the lines and that we're trying to employ critical thinking when we analyze the old works of history?
Yeah. Well, I guess, again, it comes down to the kind of evidence you're looking at. You know, tax records or you know, parish priests and their records of births and things like that to estimate population sizes, whatever. That, I think, can become fairly quantitative. Quantitative history, I think, is good. The kind of stuff Jared Diamond does, I think, is excellent for formulating hypotheses and then testing them using the comparative method of looking at different areas around the world where the experiment was run. We can't run those experiments. It'd be unethical and illegal, but the experiments are naturally run. Where you have two islands of different geographical conditions, or they're invaded by different countries. Jared's got a nice example of whether the Napoleonic rule in European countries was good or bad for economies. Well, you can test that hypothesis, but if you can define what you mean, quantitatively define what you mean by a good economic outcome, which is more people get more wealthy. Mm-hmm. And the answer is it was good, yeah, because he overthrew the old feudal systems, which prevented the average guy from accumulating wealth. So how do you test that? Well, there, because Napoleon conquered some countries and he didn't conquer other countries, and some countries that he conquered, they continued with the Napoleonic system, and others reverted back to the old feudal system. So there you have like three different experimental conditions, and then you can track the outcome over the next century of their economies, their gross national product, and that sort of thing. And that's been done. And you can say, look, there's the data. This is the hypothesis. The hypothesis is tested, and there's our conclusion. So Jared's books, I think, are splendid examples of history as a science.
Excellent. Well, in closing, I have maybe a philosophical question for you. I don't know if you heard, but about a year ago, there was talk about Auschwitz and the notion that it was falling apart. And there was a debate between whether we should let it fall apart or whether we should maintain it. And I'm just curious, what's your take on, should we preserve these types of locations for the benefit of people learning, or do we want these to sort of vanish away and
I think it'd be good if they were preserved. I've been to Auschwitz, and it is falling apart. Well, it's in Northern Europe, and the winters are brutal. So, and the Nazis dynamited all the crematoria when they left in January of 45, when the Soviets were moving in. So it's just rubble there. And last time I heard, I thought they were reconstructing one of the gas chambers. Maybe they didn't get the funding for that or whatever. But that would be good, just so people can see, based on what we really do know, because we have the blueprints of how the things were designed and built. We have photographs. We have eyewitness accounts. There's a lot of evidence to sort of piece together to know exactly how they were built, how they were used, and so on. I think it'd be good just to maintain that as a reminder. Definitely as a reminder. The never again, I think, is good, because it could happen again, for sure. I mean, it happens a lot, you know, quite on that scale, but, you know, Rwanda and places like that, just to remind people of our tribal nature.
Excellent. Well, Michael, thanks so much for
joining us
on Radio
for
Thinker.
That was good.
Enjoy the amazing meeting.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Are you a UBC student taking first-year economics, math, chemistry, or physics?
That stuff is hard.
Are you feeling like you need some tutoring? That's okay, because the AMS offers free and appointment tutoring for students in these subjects.
Whoa! How does it work?
It's on a first-come, first-served basis, and there's no need to sign up. Just show up with your books and your questions.
Whoa! When does it happen?
Monday to Thursday from 3 to 7 at the Sub Pacific Spirit Cafeteria, located beside the Starbucks.
Whoa! A+, here I come.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So our thanks to Michael Schirmer for that interview. And, wow, it's really hot in here. But I bet it's hotter in Russia.
Well, you know, before we go to Russia, I just wanted everyone to know that the oceans are disappearing. Okay, not
where's
quite
the,
disappearing.
Where's all the water going?
Well, it's not
it's
actually...
being frozen.
It's not actually water. But apparently one of the side effects to global warming is the plankton is not... It's not enough oxygen in the water, and there's been a big die-off of plankton. On a related note, as Ethan was mentioning, and kind of an update, Russia's heat wave is continuing. And oddly enough, they're dying more and more, but not from alcohol and swimming.
As an interesting side point, Russians are also a major food source for the world's oceans.
So apparently Moscow has been having temperatures around 36 degrees, which is like 130-year records for them. It's really, really hot there. According to coroners in Moscow, the death rate in Moscow itself is 5 times normal. The official numbers from the government say that normally about 370 people die a day. Those numbers have gone up to 700, which if we think back, going back to those swimming deaths where there was like 70 in one day, is big, but not a huge number relative to the rest of it. But on that note, because they're still swimming, the heat's getting people, there's also a whole bunch of forest fires, which apparently is causing a lot of ash, and people with asthma and that are also dying. As a response to the heat wave, Russia has announced that it's going to ban the exports of grain, in particular wheat and that, for fears that price hikes in its own country or shortages of food. Now, of course, this has also raised fears that speculators will cause a run on food similar to what happened in 2008. Although the situations are slightly different, the rest of the world's food supply does seem to be rather healthy, and there's not that same kind of fear. Plus, thanks to the financial meltdown, there is a dampening on capital speculation because there's just not much capital. On the good note, though, apparently exports of vodka are not going to be effective.
Woohoo! What were you saying about the plankton?
That seemed more important somehow.
Well, it is and it isn't. I just mentioned the plankton. It's one of those, you know, there's a huge calving of a glacier off of Iceland just recently. Not Iceland. No, Greenland.
I think the glacier was the size of Iceland or something like that. Like, it was this huge...
Iceland's pretty small, so, I mean, that's conceivable.
It was a fairly large chunk of ice, and it's, you know, sweeping down, and it's going to melt, and all sorts of things like this have been basically increasing the amount of oxygen in the world's oceans and killing off phytoplankton, which are one of the basic sort of base food sources for a lot of things that live in the ocean. And it's going to have major knock-on effects for things that live in the ocean, and ultimately us.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, phytoplankton is the root of all of the oceanic life. I mean, whales feed off it, and those whales, they don't eat it directly. Eat fish that eat squid that eat the whales eat them, so it's all part of the chain of life. But the numbers are the lowest that they've been since 1899, and again, that's just when they started doing records. It was interesting though how they measure the plankton count, if I can use that number, because it doesn't quite seem appropriate. What they do is they take something called a Secchi disc. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Secchi disc, which is just essentially it's a white round disc on a rope. And they lower it so that the circular part points up, right? And they lower it in the water, and they count until they can't see it anymore. And that's like, you know, 5. Okay, 5 feet. And they write that number down. And that's the measure of phytoplankton in the water. Because I guess phytoplankton is the only thing that clouds water.
I'm going to assume there's really, really good research behind this.
Yeah, well, I mean, phytoplankton make the water cloudy. And the cloudier the water, the more phytoplankton there are in it. And you can tell based on the color of the cloudiness whether or not it's phytoplankton. But I'm assuming they also support this with other lines of evidence.
Yeah, it seems like it'd be pretty inaccurate with waves going up and down. And
well, see, there are two lines of thought here. One, they do have what I would consider to be more accurate data. They have satellite data and all that does a more investigative, but they only have that since 1979. Now, the Secchi disk, which does give a relatively accurate measure, if not a completely accurate measure, as you mentioned, but because it such has a long history of data, right, that makes it valuable in itself. Because one of the big questions here is that, is global warming a recent event or is this a long-term cycle?
And it's really cool that this data goes back to 1899. That is a long time for a long string of data.
Well, as we know, that's when they invented the white circle disk. And so that was an advancement in science.
Well, we are running out of time. And as interesting as plankton is, we should probably wrap up. Let's go into our skeptical highlights. And my highlight takes place on August 13th. CFI is presenting a talk by Christopher DiCarlo called We Are All African. It's taking place at Westbrook Room 100 here at UBC at 7 p.m. Tickets can be purchased online at www.cficanada.ca/Vancouver. So I encourage you to buy tickets. It's going to be a fantastic talk, and please join us for the reception afterwards.
So I'm actually going to an academic conference in Portland for starting tomorrow and coming back on Monday.
Seattle's so, poor sister, Portland.
If you want to keep a track on what sorts of scientific things I'm doing there, you can check my blog, robteska@wordpress.com. But the Freethinkers here in Vancouver are having a book club, and this is, I think, the first session of the book club. It's happening at the Grind Coffee Shop on Main Street, and the book they're reading is Infidel. It's happening this Saturday at 1 p.m.
And the UBC Freethinkers are having their third Breakfast of Champions. It's this Thursday at 10 a.m. at the King's Head Pub, which is near Kitsilano Beach.
No losers allowed?
Pardon?
No losers allowed?
Yes, you must be a champion.
I see.
And I'm going to close off by promoting our next show, because our next show is a very, very special show. It's the last show where we're going to have Rob in the studio. Rob is leaving the country. His skepticism has forced him to move on to England, where he's going to go and do whatever it is he does there. And we're going to spend a little bit of next episode going over what Rob does here, what he plans to do in the future, just sort of a bit of a tribute to the contribution he's provided to the show, and hopefully will continue to provide through his dispatches when he does get to England.
Aw, thanks, guys.
Well, that's the end of today's show. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob saying have a good evening.
And this is Daniel saying after Ethan stole what I said, I have nothing to say.
Ha ha.
Well, the party is off to a good start. Guests are on time. Everyone.